This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we remember the soldiers who fought in World War II and a journalist who died telling their stories. Ernie Pyle is widely acknowledged as the finest World War II correspondent and perhaps the best war correspondent in history. He was killed in combat in the Pacific shortly before the Allied victory in Europe. James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. Tobin writes, Pyle was America's eyewitness to the 20th century's supreme ordeal. His published version of World War II had become the nation's version. America's mental picture of the soldiers who had won it was largely Pyle's creation. He and his grimy GIs, frightened but enduring, had become the heroic symbols of what the soldiers and their children would remember as the Good War. The biography, Ernie Pyle's War, won a National Book Critics Circle Award after it was first published in 1997. I asked James Tobin to start by reading one of the Ernie Pyle columns excerpted in the biography.
This is Ernie Pyle writing in a column from Tunisia in early 1943. The men are walking. They don't slouch. It is the terrible deliberation of each step that spells out their appalling tiredness. Their faces are black and unshaven. They are young men, but the grime and whiskers and exhaustion make them look middle-aged. In their eyes as they pass is not hatred, not excitement, not despair, not the tonic of their victory. There is just the simple expression of being here as though they had been here, doing this forever and nothing else. The line moves on, but it never ends. All afternoon, men keep coming round the hill and vanishing eventually over the horizon. It is one long, tired line of ant-like men. There is an agony in your heart, and you feel almost ashamed to look at them. They are just guys from Broadway and Main Street, but you wouldn't remember them. They are too far away now. They are too tired. Their world can never be known to you.
That's a chilling last sentence. Their world can never be known to you. How much did Pyle try to describe the more horrible aspects of that war? How much did he want to share that with the readers, and what did he want to protect them from?
I think he wanted to share as much of it as he thought the public could tolerate, as much as sort of was within the bounds of good taste as it was defined in the 1940s. He wanted to communicate the reality of war, and to a certain extent described certainly death, terrible injuries, battle fatigue. But sometimes when he tried to describe the gorier details, his content would be censored. There was a certain reticence on the part of the military and on the part of the war correspondents about describing too much of the really worst realities of war. In a certain sense, too, Ernie is saying here, as he said often, not just that I don't want to describe the realities to you, but there is a fundamental difficulty in telling someone who hasn't been through war what war is really like.
What was the style of Ernie Pyle's war reporting? What was different about his reporting than the other correspondents of World War II?
Ernie wrote in the first person, for one thing. Ernie's writing came in a column. He was not a person writing news dispatches about, you know, the previous day's battles, about how the war was going in a military sense, at least not very often. So he had time to hang out with soldiers, to live with units for sometimes for days and even weeks at a time, and to reflect on what he had seen and to write about it more carefully than the average sort of daily newspaper correspondent had time to write. His style was simple, declarative sentences. What came through was a tremendously sensitive, compassionate sensibility. I think that more than anything else, along with his basic genius as a prose stylist, is what made people respond to him so broadly and so in such a heartfelt way during the war.
You say that he created a new kind of war hero. What do you mean?
Well, before World War II, the kind of classic image of the soldier, of the war hero in America, it's probably captured best by Theodore Roosevelt in the charge up San Juan Hill during the Spanish-American War. It's sort of a Victorian image of heroism, of heroic advance against the foe. In Ernie's writings, what we see is a different kind of heroism. It's a heroism of endurance, It's a very different kind of war, obviously. This is industrial warfare, where what most soldiers are doing in battle most of the time is gutting it out, is just surviving against sort of terrible onslaughts of artillery, especially. And so that's what kind of comes through in Ernie's corpus, is the image of a suffering soldier who is enduring against, you know, terrific odds. And so that's really a new kind of admirable quality that he holds up to the American public.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of a column in which he described what was probably the first war death that he witnessed. Maybe you can give us the context of this column and read an excerpt for us.
This is shortly after Ernie had arrived in North Africa, which is really his first involvement in the American part of the war, late 1942, early 1943. And Ernie had covered aviation before, so he was comfortable with pilots and flyers and flight mechanics. And so one of the first things that he does is go with an Air Corps outfit and hang out at this airfield in Algeria. And so he's describing this scene, and I'll read just a little scene setter and then jump to the some words of his. It was late afternoon at our desert aerodrome. The sun was lazy, the air was warm, and a faint haze of propeller dust hung over the field, giving it softness. We had already seen death that afternoon, for one of the returning fortresses had released a red flare over the field, and I had stood with others beneath the great plane as they handed its dead pilot head downward through the escape hatch onto a stretcher. The faces of his crew were grave, and nobody talked very much. One man clutched a leather cap with blood on it. The pilot's hands were very white. Everybody knew the pilot. He was so young a couple of hours ago. The war came inside us then, and we felt it deeply. Then Ernie describes a group of flying fortresses that had been out on a mission and were coming back. Most of them had made it back to the field. One was still missing. And they wait, really, for several hours, and they give up the plane for lost. And then all of a sudden there's a flare seen on the horizon, and they realize that it's that last fortress coming back to the field, but very slowly. He says, "It seemed almost on the ground, it was so low, and in the first glance we could sense that it was barely moving, barely staying in the air. Crippled and alone, 2 hours behind all the rest, it was dragging itself home. I am a layman, and no longer of the fraternity that flies, but I can feel, and at that moment I felt something close to human love for that faithful, battered machine, that far, dark speck struggling toward us with such pathetic slowness. Thousands of men around that vast field suddenly realized that they were weak and that they could hear their hearts pounding. Our 10 dead men were miraculously back from the grave."
One of the great things about Ernie Pyle's war writing is that it's almost like he's writing letters home to all of America. He's writing in the first person. He's addressing the readers very directly. It's personal in a way that I think is very uncommon for newspaper writing of that period.
That's right. And in fact, Ernie described himself as a letter writer. Even before the war, he said, "That's essentially what I do, is write letters to people." He had developed this style as a traveling columnist before the war, spent 6 years traveling around the country and the whole Western Hemisphere, writing very much in the style that he used during the war. So it was a comfortable way of writing for him. And really the column that we read during the war is one that he'd been already writing for several years.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Tobin about his biography of Ernie Pyle, the famous World War II correspondent. His biography is called Ernie Pyle's War, America's Eyewitness to World War II. How did it work with Ernie Pyle in the military? How did he hook up with the troops that he traveled with? Did he have to get permission from anyone on top before doing it?
Well, you would apply to be a war correspondent, and you would be accredited to one theater or another. Ernie pretty quickly established himself as one of the leading reporters, and pretty soon as very much the leader. And so, the generals, the military bureaucrats were delighted to have Ernie come with whatever unit he chose to come with. They knew it was great publicity for their outfit. But he would often have a jeep to himself or would travel with a colleague, and really, especially in North Africa early in the war, would really roam around at will. Now, all dispatches from all correspondents were censored, passed through military censors before they were transmitted back to the United States. But after a while, I think it was in most cases very clear to the correspondents what was permissible and what wasn't. Everybody knew the rules. And most of the censorship rules applied simply to military security, as they do now.
This was before satellite phones. How did Ernie Pyle get his columns back to his newspaper?
Mostly by teletype. If he was in Europe, say, if he was in France near the end of the war and the campaign in Normandy, he would go to a press camp, and the dispatch would be, after being censored, it would be sent by teletype to London, and then by transatlantic cable back to New York. So it went through several steps. There were more filters than there are now, for sure.
Ernie Pyle was a columnist, not a news reporter. So you know, people might wonder, well, how did someone like Ernie Pyle cover an event like D-Day, just like a massive battle like D-Day? And so I thought I'd ask you to read an excerpt of Ernie Pyle's column about D-Day, what he chose to say about that event.
You bet. Ernie came in the day after D-Day, and he's faced with the battle being sort of a mile or so inland. He doesn't want to write about that. He wants to try and capture what had happened on the beach on June 6th. And so what I think is just a brilliant piece of journalistic strategy, he just takes a walk on the beach, walks along describing what he sees at his feet. And at first he describes some of the materiel and the just the office junk that's there and all kinds of things that are on material things that are on the beach. Then he writes, "But there is another and more human litter. It extends in a thin little line, just like a high water mark, for miles along the beach. This is the strewn personal gear that will never be needed again, of those who fought and died to give us our entrance into Europe. Here in a jumbled row, for mile on mile, are soldiers' packs. Here are socks and shoe polish, sewing kits, diaries, Bibles, and hand grenades. Here are the latest letters from home, with the address on each one neatly razored out, one of the security precautions enforced before the boys embarked. Here are toothbrushes and razors and snapshots of families back home staring up at you from the sand. Here are pocketbooks, metal mirrors, extra trousers, and bloody abandoned shoes. Here are broken-handled shovels and portable radios smashed almost beyond recognition. I picked up a pocket Bible with a soldier's name in it and put it in my jacket. I carried it half a mile or so and then put it back down on the beach. I don't know why I picked it up or why I put it back down. I stepped over the form of one youngster whom I thought dead. But when I looked down, I saw he was only sleeping. He was very young and very tired. He lay on one elbow, his hand suspended in the air about 6 inches from the ground, and in the palm of his hand he held a large, smooth rock. I stood and looked at him a long time. He seemed in his sleep to hold that rock lovingly, as though it were his last link with a vanishing world."
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Tobin, and we're talking about his biography of the World War II correspondent Ernie Pyle. I'm always interested in what draws a journalist into war reporting, into risking their life to cover a war. Let's talk about why Ernie Pyle did it. Let's start, first of all, with his childhood. He grew up on a farm, and he wanted out. He wanted an adventurous life, and he knew he wasn't going to have it on the farm. He enlisted in the Army at the end of World War I, but I guess the war ended before he got to see combat.
That's it.
So what kind of adventure, what kind of life did he seek out after the end of World War I, when he got out of the military?
Well, Ernie loved to travel and wanted to see the world, and so found that newspapering offered him probably the best chance of doing that. And quickly made lots of trips, traveled to Asia, traveled to South America, and wound up in Washington and New York as a newspaper writer. He got bogged down in a desk job for a number of years, was managing editor of a now defunct paper called the Washington Daily News, and proposed that he, to his editors, that he be allowed to just go out on the road and write. There were very few reporters who really were roving reporters, genuinely traveling all the time. But Ernie became one, and in 1935 started this amazing just journey across the country, back and forth, went to every state, went to Alaska, went to Hawaii, went to South America and Central America, and wrote a column that that appeared 6 days a week. It's an astonishing amount of work.
And let's talk a little bit about his personal life. He had a troubled marriage. What were some of the problems within the marriage?
Ernie was married to a very bright and interesting woman, Geraldine Siebolds, whom he called Jerry. But it was pretty clear not long after they were married in the 20s that she was deeply troubled, came from a troubled family. She became an alcoholic and a drug abuser and was probably manic depressive. And so he tried over the years in many different ways to try and snap her out of it, to get her into some kind of therapy. He thought that the travel column would be a way of changing, providing a constant change of scene for her. He thought that might help her. But none of it did help her. And so by the time of Pearl Harbor, they were their marriage was really shattered. Ernie was starting to have extramarital affairs, and decided early in 1942 that they had to split up, and he hoped that maybe by splitting up, it would shock Jerry into sort of a new self-awareness, that she might seek more effective treatment, and that they might be able to remarry, which ultimately did happen. But it's really to escape that real personal trauma and his own depression that Ernie went to war in the beginning. It wasn't so much that he was dying to cover the war, it was that he was dying to just get out of his situation and find a change to escape. And I think that I don't know how many reporters in Iraq would say something like that, but certainly through the history of war correspondents, there is a tradition of reporters seeing war as a way to get out, as a way to find personal escape and liberation.
You said that Ernie Pyle had depression problems himself. Why did he think that being in the front lines with the soldiers would help him get over his depression?
Well, I don't know if he thought of it in such a one-to-one relationship, but I think he realized once he was in the middle of the war that warfare was profoundly distracting, that it was a way of allowing yourself to be absorbed into something much larger than yourself. That's not to say that he was a warmonger, or that he was desperate to see gory scenes. It's that he was fascinated by the spectacle of it. And I think to some extent it did lift him out of his depression.
Well, he writes about how he found war strangely liberating. Would you read an excerpt of that?
Yes. After going overseas, Ernie spent a number of months in Ireland and England, and then he was able to go along with Operation Torch, the American, the Allied invasion of North Africa. And so he goes really without a clear sense of how long he's going to stay there. He's not really committing himself to being a war correspondent. But as the American forces go into battle and he goes along, he does find himself feeling like he's making a contribution, feeling like the copy that he's writing is good and valuable. And so he was really taken by the whole thing. And part of what he was taken by was just the sort of rugged, outdoor, difficult life that he was in. And he says this about that. The danger comes in spurts. Discomfort is perpetual. Dirt and cold are almost constant. Outside of food and cigarettes, there are none of the little things that make life normal back home. There are no chairs, lights, floors, or tables. There isn't any place to set anything, or any store to buy things. There are no newspapers, milk, beds, sheets, radiators, beer, ice cream, or hot water. A man just sort of exists. Either standing up working or lying down sleeping. There is no pleasant in between. The velvet is all gone from living. But as I say, Pyle also finds this life really exhilarating and liberating. He says, you don't have appointments to keep. Nobody cares how you look. Red tape is at a minimum. You have no desk, no designated hours. You don't wash your hands before you eat, nor afterwards either. It would be a heaven for small boys with dirty ears.
James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.